You know, the thing is, a barbecue, especially these really big barbecues, was a Black experience enjoyed by whites from start to finish.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Adrian Miller lives in Colorado, but he has more than earned his merit badge as an honorary Southerner. His first book, called Soul Food, won a James Beard Award. That's like an Oscar in the food world. He also wrote a book called The President's Kitchen Cabinet about the Black cooks who have fed first families over the years. And now he has a new book called Black Smoke about the Black men and women who were among America's barbecue pioneers. Adrian's book taught me so much about where our barbecue came from, how it's evolved, and why we argue so much about which barbecue is the best. I won't dive into that argument right now, except to say this show is based in North Carolina. I learned even more about all these things from talking to Adrian. Here's our conversation. One of the sparks for this book, it sounds like, was something you saw on TV years ago involving somebody who, maybe not as famous now, but was pretty famous back then, Paula Deen. Could you sort of explain what that was and how that partially led to this book?
Yeah. First of all, so good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
So, 2004, I was watching the Food Network, and there was a commercial for Paula Deen's Southern Barbecue. And at that point, I knew I was going to write a book on soul food. And I had been thinking, you know, I need to learn more about barbecue, because so many soul food joints have a barbecue option on the menu, and so many Black-owned barbecue joints have soul food sides. So just given the kind of synergy, I watched this program, and then as the credits are rolling, my mouth is agape because no African-Americans were interviewed for that segment. And, you know, it was an hour-long special on the South. So my first reaction was, how does that even happen? And then my second reaction was, well, maybe I got it twisted. Maybe it was Paula Deen's Scandinavian barbecue, and I just wasn't paying to the ad. But it's easy to make fun of Paula Deen for this, but I actually don't blame her that much, because I've been involved in these shows, and it's really the production company, because they scout the locations, they figure out who you're going to talk to. And as the talent, quote unquote, I'm sure she was just plug and play, right? So, but it was endemic of what was going on in media at that time, because I started looking around, not only at that show, but just magazines, newspapers, and all this stuff. And I was just like, man, African-Americans, you really don't hear about them with barbecue. And facetiously, I just wondered aloud, hey, do people even know that Black people barbecue? So that started me on the journey towards this book.
I was sort of brought up to understand, I guess, that black people basically invented barbecue, and that this, I guess, the narrative that was just sort of absorbed over the years was that it was part of the part of slavery, that slaves were giving these tough cuts of meat by their owners, and that they turned it into something magical because that's basically all they had. Your research obviously shows that it's a lot more complicated and goes back way further than that. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so, you know, I grew up with the same narrative about African-Americans and barbecue, but as I looked into the history, and let me just say this, the barbecue history is hazy, and I use that, you know, that term, intentionally, because it wasn't, a lot of the stuff was just not written about, and the accounts that we get are kind of sparse. They're imprecise with the language. So we're just trying to figure this out. But it seems to me that really what we call barbecue today is really Native American in origin. It's based on their meat cooking / preservation techniques that later on Europeans graft on kind of their grilling traditions to create kind of this intermediate form of cooking. And then enslaved Africans and later enslaved African Americans get into the mix as the principal cooks. So their adeptness at seasoning and also meat cooking traditions, and then just decades of honed experience, eventually becomes what we know as Southern barbecue. And, you know, really, until you get to the 1890s, turn of the 20th century, barbecue was not about lesser cuts of meat. It was about whole animal cooking. and not always pigs, because that's another misnomer, is that barbecue was just pork. And as soon as pork arrived in the South, then we have barbecue. No, they were doing pigs, sheep, cows. If they did cows, because of the size, they would quarter them. But it was really whole animal cooking. And so this whole idea of smaller, lesser cuts of meat really shows up much later.
And back then, you know, in the Civil War days and certainly after that, I think some of the first, it sounds like some of the first black celebrities, I'm not sure if that's quite the right word, were these barbecue cooks who cooked these gigantic events, a lot of times at political events where there'd be like tens of thousands of people. Could you sort of describe what your research showed about those kinds of things?
The reason why barbecue is tied to slavery is because barbecue in its earliest forms was very labor intensive. It was a big production, even if you were doing a small barbecue, because you had to find this area. It had to be cleared of brush and stuff to be suitable for the event to take place. And then somebody had to chop a lot of wood, burn it down to hardwood coals. You had to get the animals, butcher them, process them, you know, butterfly them, stick poles in it, and then dig a trench, fill that up with the hardwood coals, and then have a separate fire being tended to replenish the coals. And then somebody had to flip this meat for hours, and then somebody had to come in and sauce it so it didn't dry out. So you could see it was a big production. And so the racial norms of the time was, hey, if you wanted to have somebody do a lot of hard work and not compensate them, enslaved Africans and later enslaved African Americans. So the two, I would say, community leaders that really figure out barbecue can bring huge crowds are politicians and preachers. And so you get these political rallies, like you said, that just have tens of thousands of people. And the same was with preachers, with these things called revivals or camp meetings, which would often be multi-day affairs, and barbecue would be part of that. And so, so you just have these massive barbecues, and eventually African-Americans get known as the principal cooks. In fact, I found a newspaper article from a Richmond, Virginia newspaper in 1839, and it was describing a quote-unquote authentic barbecue. And it said, you have to have a Negro man and his assistants do X, Y, and Z. So that shows you that blackness and barbecue were wedded well into the, you know, early in the 19th century. And so after emancipation, you've got these, you know, a group of people that have a highly marketable skill that few have, and the taste of barbecue did not diminish. And so African-Americans become barbecue's principal ambassadors.
As you were talking about all that, it made me think about, you know, as you describe the work involved in doing a barbecue and how labor intensive it was. And not only that, time intensive in terms of years of learning how to do it. And it sounds to me like what came out of that through a white lens is, here are this group of people who sort of naturally gifted at this. And it made me wonder if it's sort of like these old tropes about having rhythm or being able to sing in a certain way or something, these sort of like backhanded compliments, and that this ability to cook barbecue kind of fell into that category. Does that sound right to you?
Oh yeah, definitely. And you know, the thing is, a barbecue, especially these really big barbecues, was a black experience enjoyed by whites from start to finish. Because you would have African-American cooks doing the barbecuing, and then you would have African-Americans serving these massive amounts of barbecue. And then after the barbecue was over, you had African-American entertainment. And so African-Americans would sing spirituals or plantation melodies, do cakewalks or other dances and other things. And so that was all part of it. And it was only after all of that was done that African-Americans got a chance to partake of the barbecue themselves. Well into the 1940s and 50s, people could go on excursions to Southern plantations and have this replicated. And so it was just really fascinating. And again, that just shows how blackness and barbecue had been wedded for such a long time.
Yeah, and I'm old enough to remember when I was a kid, maybe in the 60s, early 70s even, that there were barbecue places that were sort of marketed, not exactly that way, but sort of the Aunt Jemima sort of thing.
Right. And it wasn't just in the South. I mean, there were barbecue places in California that were called Plantation, you know, Uncle or whatever, you know. So it evoked kind of this idea of the antebellum South. And so, yeah, that was the notion that spread across the country.
There's another aspect of that, sort of the flip side of it, when you talk about in your book about the connections of barbecue to Black churches and Black theology, you talk about this idea of radical hospitality and how barbecue plays into that. Could you kind of explain what you're talking about there and how it fits together?
Sure. So with a lot of things in the antebellum South, the role of Christianity in African Americans was complicated. And so typically on the plantation, to the extent that the slaveholder would allow kind of expressions of Christian, religion, because for a lot of planters and slaveholders, they were conflicted because their theology said you can't enslave another Christian. And so there was various approaches to that. But usually the way that church played out on a plantation was you could have a Black or white preacher, but they were confined to only preach about the scriptures that undergird slavery, right, that justify it. And so the thing about, you know, slaves obey your masters, that was often what they were told. And it was very kind of regulated in terms of what they could do. So the contrast was these camp meetings, which again were, they were these multi-day worship experiences out in the open. So you would have hundreds, maybe even thousands of people. And African-Americans could express themselves much in a freer sense than what was on the plantation. So what I argue is that through food, worship, and other things, it was really a glimpse of what was possible for African-Americans, and that you could be accepted for who you are because you are a Christian brother or sister. Now, you know, it wasn't like 100%, but it was definitely more in that direction, more than probably what African-Americans had experienced with the constrained religious practices on the plantation. And so because a lot of times when African-Americans would be talked about in terms of equality and other things, it was the afterlife, right? It was like, you get your reward in the afterlife. The barbecue camp meetings and this freedom of movement and expression gave them a glimpse like, hey, maybe you can have that in this life, on this side of eternity.
Every so often in this book, you sort of drop into the narrative, a profile of some barbecue, Black barbecue pioneer over the years, going way back into the 19th century up till pretty close till now. Is there one person in that group, those little profiles, that you were sort of especially excited and fascinated by?
Yeah, so I think for me, it was this guy named Columbus B. Hill. And probably because he has a Colorado connection, but he's from West Tennessee. And he shows up in Denver around the late 1870s. And I believe he came to Denver because he had a brother who was a highly respected waiter at some of the finer establishments in Denver. And so his name was Mohican B. Hill. And so Columbus comes out, and then in short order, he's doing barbecues for 5,000 people in Denver. In 1882, there was something called the Denver Merchants Barbecue that was written about extensively. So he was one of the barbecuers there. And then by 1890, July 4th, 1890, when the cornerstone for the state capitol was laid, he did a barbecue for 20,000 people right in front of the capitol. It was written about, drawn about in the newspaper. And then the other thing is the kind of his most controversial barbecue is there's something we call the stock show here. It's a big deal. And at that time in 1898, it was unclear if the Denver would be the permanent host for this annual stock show. It was called the Stock Growers Convention back then. And so some wealthy Denver people said, hey, let's have a VIP barbecue, 5,000 people, really show it out and show them how much they're welcome. Well, word got out about this barbecue to the seedy part of town. And so 30,000 people showed up for this barbecue for 5,000. It was basically a riot and all this kind of stuff. He just seemed to be in the middle of so many things. And unlike so many barbecuers of that time, Black barbecuers of that time, he gets interviewed quite a bit. So we get a sense of his personality, his expertise. And so he was just a fascinating figure.
So one of the things you track in this book is this, as we've talked about, this notion that almost only Black people did barbecue back, you know, at a certain point, to now a point where commercial barbecue, and even many places you go in any town, is done, if not exclusively, mostly by white people. Can you kind of explain how that transition happened and why?
Yeah. So I think part of it speaks to the popularity of barbecue. I mean, barbecue has just exploded in terms of the number of people doing it. And that's really over the last, say, 20, 30 years. And I think there's a lot of things going on with that. I would say part of it is the rise in popularity of the barbecue competition circuit. And then also just media focusing on those guys and people like Aaron Franklin sharing what they do. Because, you know this, there's a lot of secrecy associated with barbecue, right? I mean,
well, one of my favorite things in your book is this whole notion of the sauce and how you can't reveal the full recipe for the sauce. I think you call it a word I'd never heard of, which is great, the recipe.
Yes.
Which is like the whole recipe, but there's like one thing missing, right?
Right. And that's on purpose, right? They may act like, oh, I just forgot. But no, that's on purpose. So yeah, so we just have a lot more people doing barbecue now than I think ever before. And because barbecue got reframed from being this traditional kind of working class thing that people appreciated the skill, but it was never really considered a craft, right? They never really talked about it in craft terms. By the time you get to the 1990s, that's definitely how people are talking about barbecue. And I think that's why you get a lot of, especially young white men gravitating to it. Dudes that would have probably done something else, they think of barbecue as a creative exploit now, and they get into it and they love it. And I'm not hating on anybody who's doing barbecue. My thing is there's plenty of room in the cookout for everyone. So there's no reason that African-Americans should be pushed to the sidelines of the narrative. Just tell the story. And here's the thing. Before the 1990s, it was not a problem to have African-American representation in barbecue. Because a typical media critique is like, y'all have never given Black people any love in X, Y, or Z. That wasn't the case with barbecue. It really just changes in the 90s. So in a way, I'm just saying, can we get back to what we were doing in the 1980s?
Well, it does feel like, you know, now that there's kind of the smell of money came around it, right? That there are people sort of elbowing their way in.
Right. And that's part of calling it a craft, right? Now you can make the same thing and charge a lot more money for it. The idea that people are paying $30 a pound for brisket, that a slab of ribs is $24, a whole chicken is $24. That would astound anybody who grew up eating barbecue, especially before the 1990s. But here we are. And part of it is you've got a lot more fine dining chefs in the mix now when it comes to barbecue. And so they're bringing a fine dining sensibility to this working class food. And they're telling people, yeah, you should really use high quality meat. Should we be barbecuing with Kobe beef or Wagyu beef? And they're saying, minimal seasoning. So they're just saying, oh, it should just be salt and pepper, no sauce. You know, all of these things are fine dining sensibilities. And it doesn't mesh with an African-American aesthetic for sure. Because whenever somebody says, yeah, barbecue should be unsauced so you can taste the meat, I know me and a lot of other Black people are like, says who?
Right. And that is one of the distinctions you draw between, I mean, this is oversimplifying, but sort of white barbecue and Black barbecue, is that Black barbecue is that the sauce matters way more than it does maybe in other types of barbecue.
You know, when you talk about traditional barbecue, it was sauced, but it wasn't sauced in the way that we think of condiments today, because most people are thinking about barbecue sauce as a condiment. And for good reason, right? Because if you cook with the barbecue sauce, especially with tomato-y with sugar on it, it's going to caramelize and maybe burn. So a lot of people don't cook and they add it as a condiment. But traditional barbecue, the mother sauce was essentially vinegar and red pepper, and it was applied throughout the cooking process. And so if you've ever had North Carolina barbecue or Carolina barbecue, because South Carolina is as well, by somebody who knows what they're doing, there's a depth of flavor that's just amazing. And so a lot of people started self-promoting, calling themselves barbecue kings. And until the turn of the 20th century, it was really just about mastery of whole animal cooking. But when you get a change in barbecue where it does start to focus on smaller cuts of meat, sauce starts to take off as more of an element of that. And you find that more barbecue self-promoters are talking about their sauce. And so sauce becomes a calling card. And some of the greats, we know that their sauce was, especially African-American greats, their sauce was fiery. Because that taste of red pepper was definitely in the wheelhouse of African-American cooks. And to the point now where today, when I was researching the book, I just talk to people. So Uber drivers, I just say, hey, man, I'm in town to write this book on barbecue. What do you think is the deal with sauce? in barbecue. And I can't tell you how many people are like, oh man, anybody can cook barbecue sauce, man. That's when you know what's up.
When we come back, Adrian Miller talks about how he got into food writing after thinking about a career in politics.
Well, Tommy, the short answer is unemployment.
Which, the creation of many a writer. That and more ahead on Southbound. Those of you who've been following Southbound for a while might remember my podcast back in 2019 with the brilliant musician Ben Folds. I'm thrilled to tell you that Ben now has a podcast of his own. It's called Lightning Bugs with Ben Folds. And you can join Ben as he explores conversations with some of the world's most creative people. His podcast brings guests on for a journey of curiosity through the arts, science, medicine, politics, technology, and more. And each week, Ben creates a new original song with his guest. Maybe you too will get the urge to create something new. Follow, rate, and review Lightning Bugs with Ben Folds on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you like to listen. You can also subscribe to the Lightning Bugs channel on YouTube and watch their video releases every week. Now, back to Southbound and my conversation with Adrian Miller. Do you find that there's a big difference between sort of rural barbecue and urban barbecue?
My experience has been rural barbecue tends to be that more straightforward, you know, one or two sauces. But usually they specialize, right? They're really good at a couple things and that's what they serve. And I love that because my experience has been in a lot of places that try to be all things to all people. They only do a couple things really well and everything else is either passable or not that great. And one of the things that just annoys me, and this is just me, I hate it when I go to a place and there's all these regional sauces on the table. And it really bothers me with North Carolina because that sauce was not really meant to be a condiment. It's something that, you know, is applied throughout the process. And so I think of one reason why a lot of people have an attitude about North Carolina barbecue is they haven't, outside of North Carolina, is they haven't gotten the good stuff. And people are making barbecue one way and they're just adding that sauce on later. So I just find that urban barbecue tends to be a lot more varied. And you know, if you're just a person who loves variety, then, you know, that's going to be your place. But I just love those rural joints, that tend to be just really simple. I think about Jones, barbecue, which just experienced a devastating fire in Marianna, Arkansas. You know, the barbecue there is chopped pork and two slices of white bread, and they douse a vinegary tomatoey sauce on it. Maybe you can get some slaw. That's it, brother.
There were two little details in this book especially that just kind of turned my thinking on stuff that I've just never even considered in my life. One of them is even how barbecue is spelled can signify something one way or the other. For example, whether it's a C or a Q. Could you talk about that a little bit, about that what that Q might mean in the word barbecue?
Yeah, it was really interesting. So first of all, I'm waiting for somebody to do a very comprehensive analysis on this. But more often than not, you'll find an African-American joint spelling barbecue with a Q. And so I just wanted to see what was up with that. And then there are plenty of white barbecue joints that have Q as well. But you see it a lot with black barbecue. And there's just a lot of theories. And unfortunately, I couldn't come to any definitive point on that. You know, some thought, well, it's just to make it sound fancier, you know, almost like a French sensibility. And some point to some linguistic evidence that may come from certain African languages. But I couldn't reach anything conclusive. But I think it was a fun part of the culture. And I quote some people, you know, that say, hey, yeah, that's how we spell it. We meaning African-Americans.
The other thing that really struck me in terms of little details in this book is a discussion you have about, obviously, barbecue. When it's done well, it makes smoke, and people, sometimes neighbors don't like it and they complain to the cops or the neighborhood association or whatever. But it gets into this discussion of why more poor people and black communities tend to live on the east side of town.
Yeah.
Could you explain that? Because that was fascinating to me.
Yeah, you know, and it's not, it's something I just had not thought about. And then I came across some other guy's work, and he was, you know, he's doing a whole lot about east side communities. And, you know, it's just basically the prevailing winds blow from west to east. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
I had never thought of that.
I didn't either. And so it then made sense, like, why would certain, you know, poor communities be located on the east side of town? I just never thought about that. And again, you know, there's exceptions, right? Because we know there are other directional neighborhoods, north, south, whatever. But I just know that a lot of times I came to east whatever, and it was a black community. Or at one time, it was a heavily black community.
One of the things you talk about at length is this idea of the hurdles that black cooks and other black entrepreneurs have to go through to survive, things that just make it harder for them than it would for somebody else. And I think you kind of lump all that in the category of ill will.
Yeah.
What are some of those things that you think about when you think about those things?
So one thing is, and then really, I think the most important thing is just the lack of access to adequate capital. A lot of black entrepreneurs open up a place and they're kind of halfway closed, given that. The second is where they are located in town. You know, there was a time when black entrepreneurs could have equal access to white customers. But then later, as segregation kind of hardens and becomes more of a way of life, we start to see African Americans moved away from the main streets of an urban center to a black section. And it explains a lot why so many black businesses are run from a residential, you know, a home. Because they just can't get to the business routes, the main vein, you know, the arteries, the business arteries. And then the third part is, you know, not having an adequate physical plant for the building. You know, a lot of places are run down. And it gets kind of flipped because, you know, how you were talking about, like, there's this sense like, oh, black people are natural cooks because they've always been. And so it's a similar dynamic happens with the physical plant of a restaurant because people are like, oh, yeah, it's only legit if it's kind of run down looking. And then the other thing is just the ordinances, all the things that need to be followed. And although there's no specific study in the barbecue context, we know from studies in other contexts that African-Americans tend to have higher scrutiny in following these ordinances. So there's many more visits from inspectors, you know, for health codes, building by, you know, whatever it is. And so all of these things just add up to make it challenging for black entrepreneurs. And I think one of the weirdest things with the smoke violations is, you know, there's some instances where the African-American entrepreneur opened a place when there was nobody else really around. And so the cities grow to this place and then the new people show up and like, yeah, we don't like that smell.
There was a long time when you didn't write, when you did other things with your life. What made you kind of go into food writing? What sort of led you down this path?
Well, Tommy, the short answer is unemployment.
Which the creation of many a writer.
So I was working in the Clinton administration on something called the Initiative for One America. And yeah, I was at the very end of Clinton's second term. So roughly 2001. And at that time in my life, my ambition was to be the senator from Colorado at some point. So I was trying to get back to Denver and kickstart my political career. But the job market was really slow. So I was in DC watching a lot of daytime television. I'm not even going to tell you what shows. And in the depth of my depravity, I said, you know, I should read something. So I went to the local bookstore and I found a book by John Edgerton, Southern Food at Home on the Road in History. And early in that book, he wrote the tribute to Black achievement in American cookery has yet to be written. So I just was really intrigued by that. So I tracked him down over the internet, emailed him out of the blue. And just asked him, you know, you wrote this 14 years ago, because that's, you know, the book had been out for a while. You wrote this 14 years ago. Do you still think this is true? And he said, you know, nobody's written the full story. There's always room for another voice. Why not yours? So with no qualifications at all, except for eating a lot of soul food and cooking it some, that started me on the journey. And my first iteration was I was just going to write the definitive, you know, I was going to answer that call and write the definitive book on African-American culinary history. And I reached out to a lot of food writers and they said, yeah, you know, you're not going to find that much. So just cobble together the book, best book that you can. So I thought it was going to be fairly easy to write. because there was not that much information. But thanks to this newfangled thing called the internet, I realized I had enough to write 5 books in short order. So that's why I drilled down on soul food.
This thing that you did in the Clinton administration, this, I think it was called like the One America Initiative about racial equity. Did that study, did that work sort of inform the work that you've done in food?
I would say not directly, at least not the initial work, but it certainly is playing much of a more of a role now. Because really the first work was like, oh, I'm just going to tell this untold story and see what happens. But as I've seen the reaction to my books and how I've been embraced in different circles, I'm thinking, well, what is the power of food to bring us together? Because unfortunately in our society, we have fewer and fewer spaces where people from different walks of life can come together. And one of the few places left is the table. I'm just thinking, and you know, everybody eats. Cooking is an act of love, because when somebody cooks for you and feeds you, they're basically saying they care for your survival. They're saying that they love you. And then, when you sit down at a table with somebody, it just really breaks down barriers. As long as that other person's willing to talk, and that's not always the case, right? You can do a lot of stuff at the table. So I've been thinking more like, because the One American Issue was primarily about dialogue. The whole idea was that if we just talk to one another and listen to each other, we might realize that we have a lot more in common than what supposedly divides us. I know, shocking, right? And so I think, you know, these dining conversations can help in this time. And there's a lot of people thinking about this. I'm seeing more and more websites and initiatives that are food and dining focused. So the circle that needs to be squared is, how do you get that person that doesn't want to talk about it, doesn't want to hear it, how do you get them to the table? And, and then how do you get the persons at the table to hear the other person out when they're saying something completely whack in their opinion with whom they disagree, right? We got to figure out how to create those spaces, have this dialogue, and then hold the tension if we don't disagree and not think that person's horrible because they don't share my worldview. And a lot of people need to make progress on those fronts, a lot of people.
Well, I think about in the South all the time that it's so obvious that one of the things that Black Southerners and White Southerners have in common is food. Like, and there may be subtle differences and that sort of thing. And I think the further down you go down the economic scale, the more true that is. Like, poor White Southerners and poor Black Southerners basically eat exactly the same thing. But often those two groups are sort of pitted against each other for one reason or another. And that if they could sit at the table and say, oh, well, I know this stuff. I mean, this is what we eat every day. It's just some little bit of common ground.
Right. And that was one of the biggest surprises of my first book on soul food. Because I had brought this narrative that soul food was wholly created for Black people as a stigmatized food. It was the food that white people didn't want, the master, you know, all of that stuff. And I just kept looking at the sources and cookbooks and everything. And I'm like, well, you know, poor whites are eating a lot of the same stuff. And so it seemed it was more about place and class than race. And so then it's just like, okay, if that narrative exists about soul food, but that's not really what happened, you know, what does it say about other aspects of the African-American experience?
Right near the beginning of the book, one of the things that you say kind of about your intention of writing the book, I will bring Black barbecuers back to the center of the fire. Why is that important to you?
Because unfortunately, with African-Americans pushed to the sidelines, they are missing out on this barbecue prosperity boom. And so what's happening now with the ascendancy of certain types of barbecue, and I'll just say it, Central Texas is now the dominant barbecue aesthetic. I don't think that can even be argued right now. So you've got people who have been making pork for decades now saying, oh man, I've got customers coming in asking, where's the brisket? And I don't have that on my menu. And these customers are like, oh, okay. And they're just walking out. So you have a choice as a barbecue, right? Do you put brisket on the menu without having expertise? And, you know, is that product going to be good? So, I just think it's really important to say, hey, there's many types of barbecue and part of the fun is arguing over all of this stuff. But let's not just continue this narrative that's pushing African-Americans to the sidelines. And then the other thing is it's just not right to ignore the contributions that African Americans have made, because this is one of the most delicious things on the planet. It's a popular worldwide tradition, and I just hate to see that it's divorced, that African Americans are divorced from the development of that that particular food.
There's something at the core of barbecue that's just primal. It's meat over fire, tended for hours until the wondrous creation emerges. It's not much different than pottery coming from the kiln or steel coming from the forge. It's hot, exhausting work. The kind of work that, as Adrian Miller documents, was shunted onto Black people in the early days of this country. They made magic out of it. And like so many other times in the history of this country, when money got involved, white people moved in. One of the things that took me a long time to learn is that our history, our culture, our choices, they're part of everything we eat. A rack of ribs is never just a rack of ribs. But understanding that, understanding the world that Adrian Miller shows us, shouldn't take the joy out of a good plate of barbecue. Just the opposite. Maybe it'll help some of us taste some flavors that we never knew were there. Next time on Southbound, we talk to Anna Sale, the host of the excellent podcast, Death, Sex, and Money. Anna has a new book called Let's Talk About Hard Things. And in our conversation, we do just that. Hard things like repairing old friendships that have faded away in the pandemic.
There's just not space. There's not been space to do like the friendly phone catch-up thing. So I'm trying to do more like when I do take a break and go out for a walk, just to call the friend. And even if it's leaving a message, like just to try to stitch back some of that connective tissue.
That's in 2 weeks on the next episode of Southbound. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.